And I'm trying to remember Menchel. He said maybe the internet's not working. He's he tells me every morning on Zoom.
He didn't want to leave 2,000 people.
One of his kids isn't feeling well.
Okay, before Shlema, yeah. I was on his podcast. It's a very chashuv podcast.
It's a good one.
Thanks. Okay, so we should just get started. Okay, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me to speak with you this morning. I always feel like there's nothing better than when mechanchim get together to talk about chinuch. And that's what this is. You know, it's not me speaking to you or having any more or better experience than you, but just talking together about chinuch. Yeah, I was recently on a trip with a number of rabbanim, and we just took a trip together to go visit Talmidei Chachamim and to talk and learning with different people, to talk in Hashkafa with different Talmidei Chachamim. And what I found was that it was like 10 of us, 10 rabbis, and we were on a bus. Someone rented a bus for us, and we just spent 2 days together. And what I found was, as great as it was to talk to like Rav Lapiansky and Rabbi Friend and, you know, all the different Talmidei Chachamim we visited, the best part was the bus trip. You know, that was... the time on the bus was just, you know, we weren't like, you know, singing songs, and but it was just schmoozing together and just talking over the malacha. There's nothing better than that, than collaborating on chinuch. I had mentioned this to Akiva Block. You know, really, Akiva Block teaches in SAR. He told me that, I don't know if they do this in Cushion, but in SAR, I know we didn't do this in DRS, he said that once a week they get the I don't know if it's the Rebbeim or the entire Judaic staff or something, they get together for a week and they learn b'chavrusa. They learn the masechta that the yeshiva is learning, kiddushin or whatever. They learn b'chavrusa just to learn, just to be able to talk and learning, which I thought was really remarkable. I told Rabbi Eli Storch she should start doing that at DRS. It's really an amazing thing. So there's nothing better than that than getting mechanchim together to talk about chinuch. And I thank Rabbi Mintz very much for inviting me to do that. I still wasn't sure like what to actually start discussing. So thank God Rabbi Schlosselberg came through. Yeah. Yesterday, and what must have been a very boring proctoring day. So thank you very much. I remember those days. It's like when I moved from high school to teaching post high school. Like there are a few things that like the concept of a sheer assistant. Oh my gosh, it's like life changing. Like I don't have to grade any tests anymore. You know, I'm just trusting my sheer assistant. I mean, it's a little bit scary because my sheer assistant is essentially giving guys smicha now. But but still, you know, it's and you know, not having to proctor is pretty nice also. But you wrote up a few questions, so I figured we'll start with those questions, and maybe I'll share with you some things I'm passionate about. And please interrupt me at any time and share with me your thoughts and tell me what I'm getting wrong and what I just don't get, or you know, perspectives that you have from years in chinuch, because obviously I'd like to learn. I'm also still in chinuch, so I'd like to learn from everybody here as well. So one of the questions that was submitted was about handling teaching Masechta Shabbos when the parents aren't Shomer Shabbos. So this is like one of those cases where, I taught in a modern Orthodox high school for 18 years, but modern Orthodoxy is pretty broad. And in DRS, it's an all-boys, you know, I guess the right wing of modern Orthodoxy. So, like, we didn't really have this issue, meaning the kids all came from Shomer Shabbos homes, unless there was something, you know, with a messy divorce and one parent not from, you know, things like that, where things like that happen. But for the most part, you know, the kids all came from Shomer Shabbos home. Yeah, most of your classmates were going to. Yeah, so I'm lucky to have Rabbi Shabbat as a Talmud from the early years. So he's probably thinking,
18 years you're, ago, I think
right, you're probably thinking, we destroyed you. You're going to talk about chinuch. So, okay, but just you know, hold it in. So it's not a challenge that we had very often. But one thing that came to mind is a conversation I had with Rabbi Shanker from MTA, who's an old friend of mine. So he came to visit Camp Keli last summer, or 2 summers, whenever it was. And I said, oh, you're doing all the rounds to visit all the MTA kids. So, you're going to Morasha and Misora and Lavi and wherever MTA kids are. Because I remember when I went to MTA, that's where you would find MTA kids. And he said, Now that we have like nobody in Marusha Minnesota, like we're going to Marusha Kolel, we're going to Camp Sports in Baltimore, we're going to, meaning he said like there's very few kids from MTA that go to co-ed summer programs. I said, really? Like when I was in MTA, like that was, it was not like that. And he said, yeah, the Rebbeim discourage it, and they, you know, discourage co-ed summer programs, and they have a hashpah on the kids, and they try to get them to go to more growth-oriented, Torah-oriented summer programs. So I said, how do they get away with that? Like, I feel like, you know, like, how do the parents let them get away with it? So he said something very insightful. He said that Rabbi Kahn, who's the head of school in MTA, will tell a parent who calls to complain, why is your Rebbe telling my kid not to go to... He'll say, look, you sent your kid to an all-boys high school. I'm staying on brand, meaning you're the one that's giving conflicting messages. So if you're going to send your kid to a certain type of school, you have to expect that that school is going to deliver the message that the school is advertised to deliver. You send your kid to a modern Orthodox yeshiva, so whether you're personally observant or not, you have to be ready for the fact that the kid is going to learn about Shabbos, meaning a reasonable adult has to be able to be ready for the fact that the kid is going to learn about certain things. Having said that, I think they say that Moshe Feinstein explained that the reason that they start Haskalas Gemara and Yeshivas with Eilu Metzios and not with Brachos is because he said you're going to teach Brachos to a kid, he's going to come home, he's going to see his parents don't make Brachos, it's going to be very confusing for him. But he doesn't know if his parent found the Metziah and, you know, was Machriz or wasn't Machriz. Like, he's not going to know the difference between that, you know, so you don't want to give conflicting messages. So I get that, but I don't think it's a conflicting message to teach about Shabbos. You know, one could have taken the angle of, well, if you're teaching Masechta Shabbos, who says you have to learn Hilcha Shabbos? You could focus on Lamdas, you could focus on reading, you could focus on other things, but I think that would be a lost opportunity. Meaning, if you're teaching Brachos, if you're teaching Shabbos, to not show how the Torah Shebaal Peh develops and leads to Halacha, and how what we do as Jews is not just a list of dinim that some, you know, that a teacher gave out or that a teacher spews in the front of the classroom, but it actually is like this living Torah that developed over centuries. To not show that when you have the opportunity to do so would be such a waste, to not show that. So I think it would be, you know, I happen to have a passion for teaching halacha, and I used to do a thing on the first day of halacha class every day in every year in DRS. I would come around and say, okay, if your favorite subject in the entire world is halacha, please raise your hand. And like nobody would raise their hand unless they were doing it like ironically, you know, like unless it was a joke. But like the kid who raised his hand was a class clown, right? Meaning that was so. And to me, that was a pella, because halacha is what determines everything you do all day, every day. It's the most relevant part of your day. But it's extremely boring when it's just taught as a list of dinim. Meaning if you see that it's alive and that it develops over time, and how you go from a pasuk to a gemara to the rishonim, and to see how the halacha plays out, and how different posts can be interpreted differently, and it could be done on a very basic level. You don't have to be so advanced to be able to share that with young talmidim and talmidos. It comes alive. So I would not say just do lamdas and forget about the halacha. Absolutely focus on the halacha. I do think that it's important to make the point, in this context or any other context, that every human being is a work in progress. And that nobody does everything perfectly. No Jew does everything perfectly. And you know, there are very, and our job is to find the admirable qualities about people and to respect those qualities and learn from those qualities. I always, always think it's important to emphasize the importance of Kibbutz Ave'im. I always like to point out the Chachma Sadam writes that when it comes to the mitzvah of Kibbutz Ave'im, the mitzvah is both b'machshava b'dibor u'b'maisa, the Chachma Sadam writes. So what does it mean, b'maisa? So b'maisa is what the Gemara says. How do you do kibbutz aveim b'maisa? Parent needs a drink, so you get him a drink. Parent needs help with something, you help them out with something. You need to go shopping, you go shopping. B'dibor is that you speak nicely and you speak respectfully, and I think they say that that the Altar of Slobodka got upset once at one of his Talmidim, it was Rav Simcha Wasserman. He saw Rav Simcha Wasserman and he said, how's your father doing? And he said, not bad. And he's like, that's the way you talk about Rav Elchanan? Not bad. You have to speak in more reverential terms. But so b'dibur, just in the way that we speak about our parents, what does it mean b'machshava, that a person should have kibravei b'machshava? So Chachma Sadim writes that in a person's mind, their parents should be gedolei olam, that you should view your parents as gedolei olam, despite all the evidence to the contrary. Meaning, you may be the only person that believes that they are gedolei olam, but so what, you're supposed to lie to yourself? No. You find those things that they're really good at, and the really admirable qualities and traits, and we should always emphasize those positive qualities, highlight the positive traits of people, both that are Torah observant, that are not Torah observant, and they'll have different qualities. One of the more touching things that that Rav Aaron Lapiansky told us on this trip that we were just on, our little rabbi's field trip, was Rav Lapiansky told us that when he was a little boy growing up in the Lower East Side, so back in the day, I'm sure you all know, the Lower East Side was like, you know, it was, if you were a Jew, you were on the Lower East Side. That was, he said, like, the Bialystok Shul in the Lower East Side on Yom Kippur would have 1,000 people in the building. Now, I mean, it's not like that anymore. You know, now if they get a minion during the week, it's because people are catching a minion before they go to work, who really live in Long Island or something. That just, that's what it used to be. 1,000 people. And he said politicians and gvirim, rich people, everyone. He said almost nobody was observant. Everyone was wearing talus like a scarf, and you know, no one was really. Very few people were actually fully observant. But he said it was jam packed. And he said his father, Rav Lapiansky, said his father was the gabbai, and his father used to sell the kibudim as a package, you know, like in Simchas Torah they'll sell Atar Reisa, where you buy the whole paragraph and then you could decide who to give the different psukim to. So he used to sell all the Yom Kippur night or all the Yom Kippur kibudim as a package. So he sold to this guy. There was a guy in the shul who was very wealthy, who had started off selling fruits on the street, and then he got himself a pushcart, and then after that he got himself a storefront, and then at a certain point he became the largest distributor of fruit on the east coast of the United States. So he was like a very wealthy fellow, and he bought all the kibbutzim for Yom Kippur for $150. Okay, inflation, you know, but that was a lot of money back then. And Rav Lapiansky said that as a little boy he accompanied his father, and his father walked over to the man and said, "Who do you want me to give the kibbutzim to?" And the guy said, "I want you to look around the shul and find people wearing sneakers and give the kibbutzim to the people wearing sneakers." And there were very few at that time that knew that you weren't allowed to wear leather shoes on Yom Kippur. And Rav Lapiansky said, as a 6-year-old, I think he said he was 6, maybe 8, he said, as a little boy, he said, "But wait, there are politicians and rich people here. There are people that you need to honor." And he said, this man who is not Shomer Shabbos, who is not Shomer Torah Mitzvos, put his hand on his shoulder, on Rav Lapiansky's shoulder, and said, "All of those things you just said, that's garbage." He said, "The people wearing sneakers, those are the people that need to be respected." And it's a moving story for a number of reasons, but to me, for the fact that Rav Lapiansky told it about a guy who was not Shomer Shabbos, but he said that's an admirable trait, that someone who knew what to admire and what to be mechabed and what to, you know, to highlight things like that, I think is very, very valuable. So I don't think we should shy away from teaching halacha, even if we may know that not every family is fully observant of the halacha. And as long as we're giving a consistent message of, you know, you should honor your parents, you should respect your parents are gedolei olam in your eyes and should remain that way, and you're collaborating with the parents constantly, because that's what it really is. It's really a partnership between parents and teachers. I always found, like, at parent-teacher conferences, I don't know, I'm sure this doesn't happen by you, but sometimes in the teacher's room, after, like, the day after parent-teacher conferences, so teachers would use that as a safe space to just, like, vent about their experiences the night before parent-teacher conferences. And sometimes the teacher will be like, "I can't stand all these parents. They think their kid is the biggest tzaddik. They think their kid is like such a, you know, and he's a mazik, and he's this, and he's that." And, like, I always felt like, it was, Parents Teacher Conference was the most eye-opening experience for me. Like, I love the kids, not as much as their parents love them, and I know them not as well as their parents know them, and when a parent tells me about, you know, what a kid's struggle is, or why, you know, or how he lacks confidence, oh, so that acting out is really a lack of confidence. It's not like it's not an overconfidence. It just puts everything in a different light for me. And I always felt that, like, a parent should absolutely be the person that comes to defend the kid. I was always put off by the parents that say, yeah, he's a lowlife, he's rotten, just do it. You're his parent. If you're not going to have his back, then who's going to have his back? Like, I always thought it's like a spouse, right? Like, if I might disagree with something that my wife says or does or whatever, but I absolutely will defend her to the death because that's what you do when you're, you know, that's what you're supposed to do. I once got a call from some. This is totally off topic, but I once got a call from somebody. Not I got a call. I once called up somebody to yell at them in the shul. Someone in my neighborhood. The woman did something that I thought was totally inappropriate. So I called her to say, look, you can't do this. Like, it was something public. It was not right. So I really gave it to her over the head. And then I didn't realize at the time, I was a young rabbi, I didn't realize that if the rabbi goes out of his way to call you just to give you musa, like, that's, it's a little much, you know, to do that. And like 15 minutes after I hung up the phone with her, I see on my phone that her husband is calling me. So I'm like, oh gosh, what am I going to do about it? You know, this is not going to be comfortable. So this could have backfired terribly. But what I did was I picked up the phone and I said, I'm so happy that you're calling me. I said, I'm so proud of you for calling me. And he said, like, he was thrown off, like he was came ready for a fight. So he said, what? I said, look, I know that you know that what your wife did wasn't totally appropriate, but I also know that your job is to defend her. So you're doing exactly what you should be doing. You're calling to yell at me to defend your wife because you're doing exactly what you should be doing as a husband. So it could have backfired. But he said, his response was, I'll never forget the words, he said, all right, Rabbi, so we had this conversation. we had this conversation. Meaning, of course you should defend her, and of course parents should defend their children and should want to. So I always found that to be eye-opening, and parent-teacher conferences to shed a lot of light. I don't think it has to be a conflict just because there are certain behaviors going on in the home that teaching other behaviors necessarily means that you're teaching a child to disrespect their parents. Anyone disagree? Any thoughts?
I think part of the struggle I have is often, like you said, our families, we have a very wide range of families, but often the message they're getting from the families is not the message that we're giving them. To Shmir Shabbos as an example, or kashrus is an important example, or happens to you right now, haircuts for boys, these fade cuts are very popular.
Right.
So it's sort of like, it's like mutav shishogim kind of a question more. When do you, pursue this and talk about it and make it a topic of discussion? When do you say, okay, it's not what they're up to? And
So that's the difference. Meaning the question as was posed was, if you're teaching Masechta Shabbos, meaning, so if that's your assignment, if you're supposed to be teaching, let's say, Hilchos Shabbos, you cannot avoid Hilchos Shabbos.
We're going to decide we're supposed to be doing
this. Okay. But if you happen to notice something, like we once had a boy in yeshiva who unfortunately was diagnosed with cancer in 11th grade, and his friends, in a sign of camaraderie and support, all shaved their heads, including their peyos. And they meant well. One guy kept his peyos, but he didn't know the dinim of peyos, so he kept like this much over here. He didn't know that these are the peyos. But okay, so. You know, it was amazing. So, like, one of the rebbeim yelled at the guys, like, "What are you doing? Is against the halacha?" And like, what a lost opportunity, right? To build them up and say, "It's amazing how you love your friend and what you want to do for you." I mean, thank God, I get emotional when I talk about it because the kid, Baruch Hashem, had a refuah shleima. He has a family. He's just had an opportunity to spend time with him. Last year when I was in Florida, like Baruch Hashem, but that whole chevra, we're doing something beautiful. Some of them were ready to hear it, some of them were not, but those who were ready to hear it probably should have been dealt with privately, to call them over and say, look, just to know this is great what you're doing, but you know there is. I mean, they're not. They probably went to Dunham if they would have known. They have to look like a chassid. Like, much easier to look like Michael Jordan than to look like a chassid. But Aval Bikain, you know, I think so. If there are certain things that you have to know the kid, and you have to know if you could deal with it privately. You have to know if the impression the kids are going to get is that shtika koda, that if you don't say anything, that it must be that everything they're doing is correct. Certainly can't be machzik yidei over averi. You're not supposed to say cool haircut, you know, if the kid got up their payas. But you know, kshem shemitzvah lomar davar nishma. You know, you have to be careful not to say davar shlo nishma. At the same time, you're also planting seeds. So if you could say it in a way that's not off-putting and that's not, you know, to plant seeds of what, when they decide to grow in their Yiddishkeit, they should know what that looks like. They should know what Yiddishkeit looks like. They should know what that. They should have some basis of knowledge for it. So again, if it's part of the curriculum, and you have every right as a Jewish Orthodox school to make Hilcha Shabbos part of the curriculum. So if it's part of the curriculum, I think you'll hold back nothing. If it's reacting to something that kids are doing, so sometimes the parents don't know, and many of the parents wouldn't want their kids doing something that's wrong. They themselves don't know, and you just have to know. That's why you got to know the kid and you got to know the family. So sometimes you can say it publicly, and sometimes you can't, and you have to just find, you know, cherry pick the kids that they could speak to privately. But obviously it's not an answer, but you know, you have to use your chachman.
Maybe just going off of that, what if the kid, meaning what about the opposite case where, you know, we have students that might be doing things b'shita even though they know it's wrong, so when they ask you about it, it's to evoke a certain reaction. So how would you...
Can you give me an example?
I'm saying it could be... You know, it could be like the haircut thing. It could be like, oh, Rabbi, like, look at my haircut. Like, they want, that. This hasn't happened to me personally, but they want you, because they know there's an issue with payas, so they want you to say, oh, you know, there's this and that, just so they can, you know, rub it in your face, kind of, to how would you approach that? And it could be that, you know, you're surrounded by kids that would be receptive, you know, if you tried to give an answer, and if you don't, then it could be harming them. So do you just stay silent?
Yeah, that sounds like a kind of relationship that needs to be developed a little further. Meaning, I would probably say give them a bracha that, you know, tell them, if you want to talk about it later, we'll talk about it later, but Mir Tosham, one day you should be zocha to a nicer haircut or something like that, you know, like, you know, and just like try to diffuse the situation, not to overreact or to react strongly, but also not to be maskim. I was once, YU does a thing where Moshe Weinberger does like a, in Eretz Israel, he has like a whole farbrengen with like all the boys from all the yeshivas in Israel get together. So they used to do it in the Kruz campus, now they do it in Reshit because it wasn't big enough. They have like 1,000 kids there, it's unbelievable. And I was there once when it was on the Kruz campus, and he was ready to start speaking, and everyone was schmoozing. Like, everyone was talking. It was like, there was shh, and no one was being quiet. And, like, they all came for him, right? I mean, ostensibly, they came for Ramosh Maimon. And so how did he handle this? I would have said, like, shut up. You know, like, you came to hear this man speak. Can you let him speak? He just takes the microphone and he says, there's nothing more beautiful than the sound of dibuk chaverim, of people schmoozing with each other. Like, and then hush. And it was like, but like, it was just like such a positive way to say something. Meaning, I think there's always a way to say something positive. No one grows from negativity. At least I shouldn't say no one. No one nowadays grows from negativity. I mean, it used to be like if you were in the Rav Shir in like 1945, it could be that you grew from him yelling at you that your svara was like the svara of a shikar and a shegetz and whatever, you know. But nowadays, I think if a Rebbe would try that, you know, the kid would just be like, okay, I'm out of here, you know, go home and cry. But I think nowadays a lot of warmth and just try to diffuse those situations, but eventually the kid will appreciate it. You know, will appreciate that you're non-judgmental, and will appreciate that the love that you gave him. Another question, which talks to this question. Another question that you so kindly submitted was dealing with, you called it the class cynic, right? I would call it like class apikoris, right? You know, like the one kid that wants to push all the buttons and say all the things that he knows is, you know, so at some point it might be worthwhile at some point to talk about emunah, meaning if a kid is asking publicly a lot of questions that relate to, you know, or challenging, you know, the foundations of our emunah. Probably at some point we should talk about emunah anyway. We should probably, you know, it is somewhat tragic that kids graduate 12 years of yeshiva day school and don't know the Yud Gimel Ikari Emunah. I mean, I'm involved in geirah sometimes, and in the mikvah we ask the geirim about Ikari Emunah. When we interview them in advance, we ask them about Ikari Emunah, and they have to know it. You know, if we say, "Tell me about the concept of Mashiach," and they say, "Well, that's God," you know, like we're saying, "No, that is not God." We won't say that. Like, you know, it's hard to get the Christianity out of the person, right? Meaning, so. But sometimes, like, I think to myself, like, these people know all the Ikari Emunah. How many of our own yeshiva graduates know all of the Ikari Emunah and understand the Ikari Emunah and have talked about them? You know, we are a religion that's fundamentally a religion of Emunah. And then, because there is Emunah Bashem, we therefore have an obligation to do mitzvahs, right? That's why some of the Rishonim don't even count Emunah Bashem as one of the mitzvahs, because it's too big to be one of the mitzvahs. It's, if there's no mitzvah, there's no mitzvah. So there is a time to do that, but probably not at the time that the kid is screaming out his shtick apikorsis, you know, his little bit, his that he wants to say, his little bit of you know. I think it's, again, I would never disrespect, I would never think it's a good idea to disrespect a kid publicly or to humiliate a kid publicly, but I'll tell him, let's discuss this further after class, and stay behind so that we can make a time to talk about it and we could seriously study these issues together. He never will, by the way. Like, the chances that he would stay behind and actually want to give up of his own time to actually discuss it. Meaning, if he's really bothered by these questions, then he would. But if he's just trying to make trouble, then he probably won't. And I think it's always good to tell kids that you don't know all the answers. This isn't anything in questions, even in questions of emunah, but in questions of halacha, in questions of, you know, I've seen too many times where someone asks a question and the teacher, the rebbe, somebody just like fudges an answer, and it's like, you know that the teacher just didn't know the answer and was just too proud to say that they didn't know. I always tell my kids, you know, growing up in our house, my kids always knew when I would ask them, like, who's the person that knows more Torah than anybody you've ever met? So they would always say, Rav Shachter, right? I mean, that's obvious. So then I always tell my kids, who says I don't know more often than anybody you've ever met? And the answer is also Rav Shachter. He's constantly saying, I don't know. Now, granted, sometimes when he says, I don't know, he means, I don't have the energy to deal with that question right now. You know, sometimes it means the question was so eno muvan, it was so not understandable that I'm not even sure where to begin to answer. But very often it means, I don't know, you know, got to look into it. And that honesty and that openness, that humility, ultimately kids will want to buy into what you're selling more because of your integrity and your humility and your honesty than because of your brilliance. This was a mistake I made when I was very young. I thought that, like, teachers were successful when they were brilliant, when they were dazzling. That's not really it. Meaning, teachers are successful if you know, and the nafshi k'sivus yavis, that the when Anochi is Hashem giving himself over. So we're supposed to give ourselves up. We're supposed to give Tar Talmidim a sense of who we are, and hopefully that's good. Hopefully it's someone who's humble and who's caring, and that's what they'll ultimately connect with. I almost didn't go into chinuch because of that. I thought, growing up in my group of friends, many of whom were going into chinuch and other areas of Avodas HaKodesh, I thought, yeah, they're able to do this because they're so charismatic and they're so talented and they're so great. But I was not good at basketball. I'm tone deaf, can't play or sing anything. And, like, I can't run a kumzitz. You know, they asked me to run a tish in Camp Cayley. So I just, like, do you know, go around the room and say, like, what's the nicest thing anyone's ever done for you? Like, I don't know, you know, I don't know how to do those things. I'm not, you know, I'm not. And I thought, like, okay, so I'll go to law school, and you know, and that's a place where if they tell me what to do, I'll do it, and I'll function. But then it just struck me one day that what made my Rebbeim so great and so successful at what they did was not because of all those other things. It was just because they care so much. It was just because they, like, they were in it for the right reasons. They cared about me. And they were humble, and they were kind, and that's just something I wanted to be. And I figured, oh, I could try to do that. You know, I can't try to become musical or talented, but I could try to do that. I can't try to be brilliant, but I could try to do that. And I think that's a big key. Yeah, kids are more likely to become from an account of your integrity than they are an account of your brilliance. I think that's important. As far as one of the questions was teaching Gemara and Chumash to kids with weak skills and limited backgrounds. So this is something I feel pretty passionately about. I think that there's a common mistake that's made, that people try to set the bar really low. When the kids have limited backgrounds, so, you know, you teach them on like a preschool level. And I find that if you set the bar really low, no matter how low you set it, they'll find a way to crawl underneath it. If you set the bar high, meaning maybe it was Adam Grant or Malcolm Gladwell, one of the books, you know, you read these books, they're a lot of fun. So I don't remember which book it was, but it described like the parent who, when the kid strikes out playing baseball, it's like, great job, you did a great job. And what does a kid think when you tell him after he swung and missed wildly three times, you know, on three straight pitches that he did a great job? The kid thinks either my parent is an idiot, they don't know the rules of the game, right? Meaning, what do you mean, great job? I didn't do a great job. No, what effective parenting would be like, okay, you tried hard, but let's see what we can fix for next time. I mean, let's try to make it better. Let's see, maybe you swung a little too early, and work with him on actually improving, on actually getting better. Of course, it's much easier to just say great job and then move on. It's much harder to actually put in the work. But I find that if you just you know, define success with the lowest bar possible, so then you're not gonna get anywhere. I think it's very important to raise the bar. I remember one year I came in on the first day, I was teaching the 11th grade shiur. And we were learning Masechta Sukkah, so we did a Machlokas Tosos and the Ran and Daf Gimel Amud Aleph or something. And one kid raised his hand and goes, "Rabbi, I don't do Tosos." You know, and I said, "You haven't done Tosos, but now you will, and you're going to." Obviously, you have to provide a clear plan. You have to let them know what the expectations are and give them all the tools to be able to that they need to succeed. But make them use those tools. Meaning, there are plenty of tools out there. The kids aren't idiots. Meaning, they're if they're able to take. I would always come in on the first day when we learned Maseches Makos. I remember I took an AP Bio book, which is like, you know, it's like a phone book. I guess that's a dated reference also. There used to be such a thing called a phone book, but like, imagine printing out all your contacts, right? So as I took an AP Bio book and a Gemara Makos. Gemara Makos is like this thing. Like, if you could do this, can't you do this? Right? And if you can't, like, what does that say about, you know, your Judaic knowledge and your Judaic striving and what you strive for, what you want to accomplish? And there are tools to make them succeed. So what I would do, again, every school is different. Every, you know, you have to figure out on their level. But I was not teaching the honors here. It was not. These were kids that fumbled over the words of Gemara a lot. They certainly cannot make a leaning on it. They cannot read a Gemara. But what I would do is I would record Amud Shiurim of Gemara's, you know, of the Gemara, a whole Amud, 20 minutes, a 20-minute recording, and just Gemara, no Rashi, no nothing. And then they would listen to it and put in the commas in your Gemara. I would say, okay, on this Amud Gemara, the Gemara really just says three things. It asks one question and gives two answers. That's one thing it says. There's a Mishnah that says a halacha, and then there's the Gemara that follows it that says it only says three things on this whole page of Gemara. Meaning, let them see the forest, not just the trees. A lot of times, they get bogged down in the trees, but if I can't read every single word, it means I'm coming away with nothing. Let them see the whole picture, and make them work for it, and then I would do a reading quiz, and at the reading quiz, I was just testing to see if they put the commas in the Gemara, if they wrote in the translations in the Gemara, and I'll give them time in the Beis Medrash to do that. It worked very, very well. That was after your time, but it worked very, very well. In teaching Chumash, when I taught Chumash to ninth graders, first time I taught Chumash, I had no idea what I was doing. I would just read every Ramban and Ibn Ezra, and it was just, we learned one parak the whole year, and it was just like every rishon and every pasuk, and it was just silly. And then at some point, I had a conversation with Rav Schechter, and he said, I don't know why teachers spend so much time on all these different rishonim, especially the ones that we don't pass on, like Lemaisa, because Rav Schechter is always, that's a gishmak, it's a libdilchse. So I said, I had an idea. I asked him what he thought of it. I said, I'm teaching Sefer Bereishis. Ninth grade, I taught Sefer Bereishis first semester. We did, first semester was Chumash, second semester was Navi. So I'm teaching Sefer Bereishis. I said, what if I did Parshas HaShavua, because first semester lines with the Parshas HaShavua. So I did a few introductory classes before Yom Tovim, and then each week we did the Parshas HaShavua, four classes a week. So one day, I'm just going to give the overview of the story of that Parsha. Here's what it says in this Parsha, from this Pasuk to this Pasuk, talks about this, and basically a 10-sentence, one paragraph summary of the entire Parsha. The second day of the week, we'll do, we'll take three psukim and we'll show how the Ramban disagrees with the Rashi, and, Parsha Nechama Leibowitz, that kind of thing. On the third day, we'll do a halacha that comes from the Parsha. Ve'avo Avram l'spol d'sar of Lifkosa. Oh, so apparently there's a din of hesped. How do we learn hesped from what Avram Avinu did with Sarah? And they saw how halacha comes from the Parsha. And then on the fourth day, it would be how Musar or Hashkafa that emerges from the Parsha. So what that did was every kid knew the plan. They knew that it wasn't just okay, I guess we're going to learn a bunch more stuff today on the pasuk that we did yesterday. Meaning, they knew the plan that, and every day was an independent lesson, and they knew that even if I wasn't paying, I was having a bad day yesterday. Well, today's a new day because it's a totally new topic. And it also gave kids an opportunity to connect on different levels. Some kids really connected to the hashkafa, some kids really connected to the halacha, very few really connected to the overview, but that's that's important, just to know what it says in Chumash. So I think having a clear plan and giving them the tools for success, and also the motivation. I discovered at some point that, and again, I don't know what the rules are in Kushner, I'm not, making any assumptions, but we, as teachers, at least in DRS, we have the ability to reward kids with points on tests and report cards, and points are free for us. They don't cost me anything. So, I was able to, but I wouldn't just throw them around, but I would say, one year I said, over winter vacation, I give these halacha shirim, roughly 10 to 15 minutes, and I would say, listen to 10-minute halacha shirim. If you write up in handwriting, not typed, back in the day, if you write up a 10-minute halacha shirim, I'll give 2 points on your next test for each 10-minute halacha shirim you write up. A kid came back after winter vacation. He had written up 43 10-minute halacha shirim. He had earned 86 points on his next test. On his next test, he got 152 or something like that, and he failed. But you know what? He spent the entire winter vacation learning. He now knows a little bit about so many different areas of halacha. That was free. It didn't cost me anything. Made him feel good. He got an A in Gemara for the first time in his life, and he accomplished something. I remember when we were learning Maseches Makos, there was one kid. Remember, the thing with this kid is he was not so great in shir, putting it mildly, and my thing with him is he never ever wore tzitzis. like I would literally buy him a pair of tzitzis and he would not wear them. There was another teacher, Mr. Mark, would Rabbi Weberman, I forgot who it was, I think maybe both of them, would buy him tzitzis regularly, and his locker was just full of tzitzis, and he never ever wore tzitzis. In his Shana Aleph, in the Tiv, he called me 2 weeks into Shana Aleph asking which sheet of Tcheles he should get, but that's beside the point. But he was a brilliant kid. He just didn't like learning. He didn't, I don't know, he felt constrained, or I don't know, but I knew he was brilliant. So I said, if you memorize 5 lines of Gemara, word for word, I'll give you 10 points on your next test. The kid memorized the entire first perek of Maseches Makos. Word for word, mila b'mila, word for word, he memorized the entire first perek. Maybe it was 10 lines, 5 points, I don't remember the ratio, but whatever it was. 5 or 10 lines at a time. He memorized the entire first paragraph of Maseches Makos. Now, whatever you're accomplishing in the classroom, are you accomplishing more than that? Like, I was like blown away. So again, he got 1,000 on every test. You know, like the system didn't allow for the numbers that I needed to put in for him. But he earned it. You know, make him earn it. But he earned it. So I think like kids can do so much. You know, my brother is a Rav in San Jose, California. So he's Rosh Kollel in Palo Alto. And he said that his kollel is involved in adult education. And he said what he finds is, like, that these doctors that work in Stanford are so smart. He said they don't need much background. they are so smart. Meaning if someone is intellectually capable, they don't, you know, even if they don't have the background, that just means you need to give them the tools to succeed. But once you give them the tools and the motivation, they can succeed. So I'm a very big believer in setting the bar higher rather than lower.
A question on one of the points you made about the boy with the tcheles 2 weeks into Shana Aleph.
Yeah, he now no longer wears tcheles because he learns in the kollel in Yeshivas Shari Yashiv, and Rav Naftali Yeager is not a fan of tcheles.
The question is not about tcheles per se. The question is, I think, so a number of us have had very positive experiences in a year or two in Israel, and understand to a certain extent of maybe where we came from doing less, and maybe chose to do more. But from your experience, what do you think, as a high school teacher, could be frustrating, where Priya Kishka's into someone for 4 years, and they grow maybe this much, and then a few months later, one person teaches them for a few hours, and they do this.
Right.
So why do you think that happens, and what do you think we could do in high school to create that growth?
Right, meaning how do you know if you're being successful, and why does it feel like you're not sometimes? And it feels like that kids amp it up so much more in Israel.
Yeah.
So first of all, I am a big believer in that you're in planting seeds, and that it's not that the kid goes from 0 to 60 in like, you know, 2 seconds flat. It's that, you know, you wound up the wind-up toy a lot when he was in high school, and then as soon as he was free from his previous environment, you know, you just let go of it, and then it took off. So I do think there is a lot of that. At the same time, there are certain advantages to just being in Israel and being away from things, and, you know, more in growth mode. But again, the more you put into that, you know, to that relationship and to that education that he got, the more equipped that. I was just talking to a Talmud last night, for example. A guy went. He said he was never Shomer Shabbos. He never observed the Shabbos until his first Shabbos in yeshiva in Israel. And he was at a top-notch yeshiva. And he said, like, he came out, like, knowing Reb Chaim's, he said, I can't name the Shvatim. He said to me, there are such huge holes in my learning right now. He said, I can't name the Parshios, I can't name the Shvatim, I don't know anything on the basic level. And he was a bright kid, and meaning if those building blocks are really, really helpful when someone does want to grow. So I don't think it should be a point of frustration. I think it should be a point of pride that they do grow. Now, I do think that we should look at where the successes are happening and see if we can mimic that, you know, and see if we can build something like that. You know, I mentioned Moshe Weinberger before. you know, why you did that essentially with or NCS, why did it with Rav Aryeh? They saw what he does in Israel with all these guys, and so they did it for high school kids, you know, and gave them that experience because it's a positive spiritual experience. So they did it for I think it was NCS why they did it. Right? So they did it for high school. So that's great. Meaning we should look. Rabbi Penner, my first year here, Rabbi Penner said, go to Gruss, spend a week in Gruss, you know, in our kollel in Israel. And try to find out what the magic sauce is and see if you could bring that back here. And the answer is most of the magic sauce cannot be brought back here, meaning it's really unique to being in that environment. But we you know, part of our jobs is to try to see what actually is working and how to create an environment of ruchnius and an environment of supporting ruchnius and how to make it a cool thing to, you know, like... It shouldn't be that the coolest kid in this, that the firmest kid in the school, by definition, is not the coolest kid in the school. Meaning, like that there's inverse proportion between frumkeit and coolness. Meaning, we have to try to create an environment where that is something that kids look up to, and that. I think it's we should realize we're planting a lot of seeds, and stay in touch. You know, scroll through your list of the guys or girls that were in your class in the previous year. I mean, we always had a Shir WhatsApp chat, my Shir. So every once in a while, I'll just go to Libo Shir 16, and I'll just scroll through the list and be like, oh, I haven't spoken to that guy in a while. Hey, how you doing? It just opens up a door, and it's like, oh, actually, I'm going through a tough time, or can I call you? Or like, just meaning, if you keep in touch somewhat, it doesn't even have to be like we're speaking all the time, that relationship is going to be invaluable for the kids, and that's there for life. Rav David Willig is the master of this. Rav David Willig is in touch with, and Rav Yehuda Turetsky and Shalvim is also, like those two, more than anybody else, is in touch with like every Talmud. It's unbelievable. My kids are always telling me, oh, I just spoke to Rabbi Willig. Well, you're 5 years out of high school. How do you just speak to Rabbi Willig? Yeah, he called to, you know, he had a suggestion or a question, you know, or something. It's a good thing to do. And they'll reach out. You know, if you keep those lines of communication open, they'll reach out when they need chassan classes, when they're going through difficult times, family illnesses, things like that. I was actually just at... On Motzei Shabbos, I got a call from a guy in my shul who was down in Florida because his brother-in-law was very, very ill. Like, a young guy, just very, got very, very sick very quickly. And the family, like, the adults of the family immediately went down to Florida to be with him. And he passed away over Shabbos. And it was, like, very sudden and very shocking. It was very close to his family. So he called me right after Shabbos. He said, can you do me a favor, go to my house and tell my children that their uncle passed away. Which is like, you know, that's part of being a rabbi, right? So so I went to the house, and the 14-year-old boy, you know, started crying healthily, as he should, you know, when his uncle dies. And we started talking a little bit, and then he said, I need to call my rabbi. And I was like, that's amazing, right? Meaning... That's the kind of relationship you want, where the reaction is, I need to call my Rebbe. And he called his Rebbe, and his Rebbe spoke to him and, you know, cried with him. And now, you know, those are the seeds that, like, you can't measure that success now. That's long-lasting. A lot of times what feels like success is not success. Like, you know, you speak somewhere and you tell a joke and everyone laughs. That feels great. But, like, did you make an impact? I just spoke on Shavuos in the Young Israel of Woodmere. Rabbi Shai Shechter puts together an afternoon program in the Young Israel of Woodmere. And the Young Israel of Woodmere is a massive shul. And he realized, like, no one's taking a nap on the first day of Shavuos in the afternoon because, like, they just slept the whole morning, right? So from 5 to 8, he's just got speakers, 600 people come. It's nuts. So I went, and I was totally unprepared. Like, there was too much going on in my life. I look, and there's 600 people. And I spoke terribly. Like, it was like I was so off. But I mentioned, like, one nekuda that had to have better kavanah in the first bracha, Shemon Esrei. Like, one little detail in the middle of a terrible, terrible shir. Disorganized. Like, you know, I'm not just being a harsh critic. Like, you know, mamish, like, objectively terrible. And since then... At least a half a dozen people, either who I've seen or have reached out to me, called me, said that changed the way I daven Shemoneh Esrei. So, like, I don't know, is that a failure? I don't know. it may not have felt good, but that was a success. If every Shemona Esrei since then, they're thinking about, you know, how to have kavanah in the first bracha, and they're doing, that's pretty good. You know, so like a lot of times you have successes that are like that. I know people wanted a break, right?
I guess we did.
Okay, so there's more to say, there's more to talk about. I feel bad that I didn't elicit more feedback from you.
What's the tip?
It'll take me a little while to explain it, but I'll just say it this way. I'll send you a voice note if you want where I explain it. I heard this from Rabbi Yisrael Reisman when he said it to a group that Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg brought from Boca Raton, Florida, to meet with Rabbi. So I connected them with Rabbi Reisman. I'm lucky enough to have a little connection with Rabbi Reisman. So Rabbi Goldberg sent me the recording, and he gave this tip and how to have kavanah in the first bracha Shemona Esrei, which, by the way, just also is awesome. Rabbi Reisman came into the room and he's like, I don't really know you, but I know that I have trouble focusing during davening, so maybe, like, I'll share with you what helps me, and maybe it will help you. And since then, I incorporated it into my davening. Again, I don't know about you. I don't know how many times I actually made it through the entire first bracha having kavanah the whole time, which is embarrassing to say, and maybe everyone's not like me, but, like, my head is in a million different places, and since then, it's been probably 3 months now. I think it came in February. Yeah, 3.5 months. I would say that maybe I've had one or two. Definitely, I count on one hand Shemona Esrei's where I did not have kavanah straight through the entire first bracha Shemona Esrei. It was an amazing tip. So I'll leave it at that. I'll send
You'll
it
have
to
you.
Send
it out,
right? But it's not easy. Meaning it's an avoda. So meaning it's not like, oh, dad, okay, now I got it. It's not like you just snap your fingers. It's like a whole Dvar Torah, a whole way of thinking about things, and then doing something physical to make sure that you're, you know, counting off on your fingers to make sure that you're actually thinking about it. So I'll send it around. You know.
Well, yeah,
okay.
No,
and I'll all right. Okay.
Remember,
yeah.